This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. On today's roundtable, President Bush's poll numbers are up and Democrats aren't happy. And the AFL-CIO invests $1 billion in New Orleans developments. Joining us today from our headquarters in Washington, D.C., economist and author Julianne Malveaux, president and CEO of The Last Word Productions. In our New York bureau, we have Michael Myers. Actually, I'm sorry, he's joining us by phone. And also Walter Fields, CEO and publisher of the NorthStarNetwork.com. Is at KISS FM in New York. Thank you all for joining us.
Good to be here, Vry.
Thank you.
So let's start out with this Gallup poll that has Democrats worried. Apparently, now that Abu Musab al-Zarqawi has been terminated, more Americans are feeling confident about the war in Iraq. 48% believe the U.S. probably or definitely will win the war. That's up from 39% in April. Does the president have momentum here? Osama bin Laden still AWOL. Is this the beginning of a resurgence, Julianne, for the Bush administration?
Oh, not at all. Certainly, the administration has every right to revel in two victories. One, as you put it, termination, I like that, of al-Zawahiri, but also Mr. Bush's surprise visit to Baghdad. I mean, those are two things that have boosted momentum, have probably boosted the morale of our troops, and have made the country feel as if we're in control of this thing. But as was reported just a few minutes ago, Farai, our casualties have exceeded 2,500 now, and you can never count on the environment in Iraq. Good today, bad tomorrow. You still have people, as Ed's interview just showed, who are very, very adamant about, you know, the whole situation in the Middle East. There are people who are not backing down. Getting al-Zarqawi was just one thing, and it's like there's someone else who's coming to replace him. This is, however, a good time for Republicans because, as you say, Democrats are in disarray. The Campaign for America's Future conference, Take Back the Future, that met here in Washington earlier this week, Hillary was booed because she does not support a time certain to move the troops. And it just goes to show she's supposedly the front runner. Much of her speech was very wildly applauded, but then she was booed. It just goes to show the schizophrenia in the Democratic Party. And until those folks can get some therapy, the Republicans basically rise to the top.
Well, Julianne, let me ask you, who are those folks? Those folks, the Democratic identified voters, those folks, the Democrats who are in office. Tell me more about what you mean.
Well, I think it's the Democratic leadership. I think that the people have been consistent with concerns about the economy and things like tax cuts. The people are concerned about things like employment. The people, by and large, even with this approval rating, 48% is not a great number. The people do not like this war. But you have Democrats talking out of four sides of their mouth. You know, it's the Rodney King thing. Can we all get along? Especially when you look at, you know, someone like Hillary, who is so wildly popular, but still tries to cleave to this center. The party literally, in my opinion, is in disarray. There have been more than enough opportunities in the past 6 months, as the Republicans have floundered on all kinds of things, for the Democrats to step up and take leadership, and they haven't done it.
But Hillary believes that she's wildly popular because she's in the center. Generally, I agree.
Like I said, therapy.
I agree with Julianne, but, you know, this is what I regard as a knee-jerk bounce from America's second, we got them. We have to remember what Gore Vidal said, you know, in mocking the president. This is wartime president. And people are knee-jerk with respect to the news. If it's good, they feel better. If it's bad, they feel awful. But, you know, the body, they still don't see the body bags, and people are still dying. This is a superficial public relations gimmickry. I mean, Julianne used the word surprise trip. I used the word secret trip. And an emphasis must be on secret, because Iraq is a very dangerous place. It's dangerous for the president. It's dangerous for people who are living there. It's dangerous for people who are trying to govern the place. And, yes, Julianne is right again when she says the Republicans benefit from Democrats being deeply divided over Iraq and the disarray of the Democratic leadership between themselves. I mean, Joe Lieberman could very well go down in Connecticut because of his waffleness.
All right. Well, let me turn to Walter. I'm going to make you role play here for a second. You're Hillary Clinton, and besides having to get pumps in a completely different wardrobe, how do you reach out to both Democrats who are centrist, Democrats who are far left, and at least a few Republicans?
You really can't. You have to decide who you are. But I think the Democrats' major problem and why their prospects could dim in November is the fact that their politics is so poll-driven. And I think what the country is looking for right now is real leadership. You know, if you look back to Ronald Reagan in 1980, you know, Reagan's positions were not that popular, but what people saw in him was leadership. And I think what the Democrats have got to do is start leading and not be so concerned about momentary turns in the polls. Hillary Clinton can't satisfy all the fractured constituencies of the Democratic Party. But what the party requires now is someone to step forward as a leader and say, this is where we should be as a party. That hasn't happened yet. And until it happens, the Democrats are always going to be in disarray.
Julianne, if you look at young voters, especially young voters of color, you find large numbers of independent voters. But because there are very few third parties or independent parties, most of those folks don't vote. Should there be more of an effort to reach out and get those people involved? And do you get any sense? Obviously, we're still quite a ways off from the 2006 election, but with the House in play and the Senate possibly in play, do you get any sense that people are trying to reach these more skeptical young voters?
I think they're small efforts, but I don't think they're significant enough for Rai. There are some young people, I think, who are doing phenomenal things, and there's some who are connected with the Democratic Party and with the Republican Party. But as you say, the key thing is that young voters, almost half of them, are registering as independents. They find no fealty with either party. They're looking at issues. They're not looking at people or parties. They're really turned off by the partisan bickering and by the gridlock. When you look at young African Americans, very, very interesting, one of the issues that wedges them is that young African Americans with children are interested in charter schools. They're interested in educational alternatives because, by and large, they live in inner cities. They're turned off by public education. Those of us who are over a certain age, we won't say what, you know, who are public education advocates. As a young man said to me the other day, he said, "You have neither chick nor child. You don't have a dog in this fight." But I think I do because I care about educational quality. And that's one of the issues where Dems are losing. For example, young African Americans, young people who are not looking at ideology, but how does politics affect the day-to-day aspects of my life? And so I think that we really got to get those folks involved in the practical aspects of politics. And I don't see Democrats spending enough time, effort, energy, or money in that. The community that I think is interesting for Rai is the blogging community, which skews young. And I think that some of the things that you like, what's his name? Daily Kos is in his early 30s.
Marcus Melitzis.
Exactly.
Yeah, DailyKos.com.
But there's only one very noted African-American blogger, and that's Chris Rabb at AfroNetson. And so, but I think that that blogging community sort of speaks to young people's alienation with the way we do politics.
Yeah, but, you know, there's a difference between self-interest and public interest. And I do know that voters generally vote their self-interest. But it is a disturbing trend, it seems to me, if young African-Americans, or for that matter, anybody who's young, who doesn't understand the context of history and the movement for public education. Charter schools mostly are public schools, but there are an increasing number of young people who believe in vouchers who do not understand the notion and the concept of the separation of church and state, for example, and only because they want their children to have the best schools they can possibly get, and therefore public funds should be put into sectarian schools, and they don't really care about people's religion or if their children have to make the sign of the cross to get a quote-unquote quality education. But they should care, and because the issues are bigger than just their children. So we who have a dog in this hunt may not have children, but we do have children of all colors, and we have a future of society we must care about.
But, Michael, what's wrong with somebody wanting their kid to have the best thing? What's wrong with someone saying that I want my child to have the best education there is, and I think that public education has failed, so let me see what the alternatives
are? There is nothing wrong with that, but if you want an alternative to public education, then you pay for it. Don't ask the public, the taxpayers, to pay for your child to go to a private school or a religious school.
Well, you know, one thing that raises a question is whose money is it? And I think it eventually becomes the money of the individual, and the individual taxpayer should have some say in how their tax dollars are spent. But I think part of what you have to do is you have to lower the altitude of political discourse. You know, you have to remember that all politics really is local. And I think if you want to engage young people, you have to engage them at a level that's meaningful to them. we often have these lofty discussions and we have these intellectual debates, but I think most people engage a political process at home where they can see it and feel it. Many of the debates in Congress have no meaning for the American public because they can't feel it, but they can feel the effects of what's going on in their individual communities, counties, and states. And I think that's where we've made the mistake. We've sort of tried to engage people at 40,000 feet when we should be talking to them at 10.
Well, that's what Rangel was saying when he says, let's end this Iraq war by bringing back the draft, because that's how we ended the Vietnam War. People were being drafted, and the young middle-class people and the family said, oh, no.
Well, Michael, hold on. Let me. I have another issue that I just want to throw into this mix, although I know we could do the whole show or the whole segment on this. When you speak about local politics, you're also not just talking about what are the intersections of federal, state, and local government. You can also talk about who are the other players in the local political arena. And in New Orleans, very interesting, the AFL-CIO plans to kick off a development investing $1 billion in affordable housing in a new downtown hotel. They are dipping into a 40-year trust fund for the money. Mm-hmm. And basically, it's an implicit critique that government has not done enough, so that this labor union is going to do it. Michael, do you think that this is mainly good press for the union, or is this going to make a significant change?
Well, I've been in New Orleans so many times, and I plan conventions in New Orleans. You don't need another new downtown hotel. What you need is a new town completely in New Orleans. And this is a union, and when I think about it, when you go to New Orleans, there are no union hotels except for two, the Fairmont and the Lowell's. So New Orleans is not a union-friendly town. So talk about self-interest. This is a union trying to get a new hotel, unionized hotel in New Orleans. But I have to say that you know, there's also the peril of haphazard development. So we need a new town concept, and we should avoid low-income ghetto development. We need mixed-income housing, economic and racially so. And to the point that they're building affordable housing, I think that's good. But there has to be some plan at this, not just haphazard.
Julianne,
the planning process heretofore has sidelined the poor, has sidelined affordable issues, has allowed the people with the money to weigh in on how the planning is done. So I very much welcome the AFL-CIO's incursion here. I welcome it for any number of reasons. First of all, the number of units of affordable housing that will be created. Secondly, you know, New Orleans was a city that was 65%. The poverty rate there was so very high. And I may misquote with 65%, but it's a very high poverty rate. 85% of the kids were getting subsidized lunches in New Orleans public schools. So when you look at that poverty rate, you had to raise a question about what people were earning. The casinos came in non-union and ended up with a series of very low-wage jobs. People were making a buck or two above the minimum wage. That's all. That does not alleviate poverty. When unions say we're going to build 10,000 units of affordable housing with union workers, what they're saying is you're not going to make $8 an hour. You're going to make $15 to $20 to maybe even $30 an hour. And I think that's a great thing for New Orleans. Someone has to weigh in. And somehow politically, people have not been able to get poor people systematically weighed in. So I think that the AFL will do some of that. Now, I will say there's an element of truth in what Michael says, but only an element, always. I mean, there obviously is some self-interest here. I think that the labor movement has been battered in the public. The well-publicized split between the AFL-CIO and SEIU and the Teamsters
Absolutely.
Has made unions look, you know, really irresponsible, I think. And this is a way for John Sweeney and his team to polish their image. But hey, if polishing their image trickles down to 10,000 units of affordable housing, I say you can polish your image anytime on my dime.
Well,
Walter,
housing is not cheaply built, and I hope it's sturdy. And I think
it's $1 billion, Michael. They're not sitting here talking about crack.
All right,
let's
let Walter into this mix. What do you think about
it? Well, you know, I think it's a good start, and I think they should be applauded for making the effort. Clearly, there's going to need to be a lot of these type of projects if the city is ever to come back. And we have to remember that it's not just New Orleans, but the South is non-union. So this is a pretty big move on the part of AFL-CIO. And, you know, hopefully what it will also do, it will raise some of the wages in that area and employ some people, including local residents in the construction process. Because the other problem in unions is the fact that in the construction trades, you have very few blacks and Latinos. So I'm hoping that if they're going down there to build this housing and this hotel, that part of the plan will be to make sure that blacks get their union cards and become part of these unions. But I think it's a good move, and hopefully we'll see other people, including public pension funds, decide to invest in New Orleans, particularly in housing for the indigenous population.
All right, speaking of housing, I've got a bonus round for you guys. We've only got 2 minutes left, so you're going to have to talk fast. I admit I'm wearing high water pants today in a big memento to the 1970s, but the 70s also was when stagflation was created, a phenomenon that led to double-digit interest rates in the early 80s, gas prices pushing consumer inflation higher, possible housing bubble. Are we going to see some rough roads ahead, Julianne?
We will see rough roads ahead, but I don't think we'll see the stagflation. That was a peculiar situation with this thing economists call the Phillips curve just not working at all, or perhaps it was shifting. But we had high unemployment and high inflation at the same time, so ordinary tools didn't work. We have new tools. Globalization provides us with a series of new tools. But you know what? We are having labor market problems that this administration does not want to deal with. And the fact that we're seeing a very slack pace of job creation, just 75,000 jobs last month, we need 300,000 jobs per month to justify the tax cuts. They said when they cut taxes, we'd end up with all these jobs. Well, we've not even hit 150,000 jobs most months. So this basically makes the administration look crazy, but it's not going to be the 70s. Take off them high water pants, my sister.
Okay, Michael.
I don't think we need new names, whether it's stagflation or stagflation light. There are many parts of our population that are already feeling inflation. And the cost of living, the cost of rent, the cost of fuel, the cost of gas, the cost of milk, the cost of food, the cost of our newspaper.
Already too high. Okay, got to go to Walter.
And they're still building big cars in Detroit.
All right, Walter, quickly.
I think it impacts different parts of the country differently. If you look in the New York City area, we're primarily being impacted by housing costs and rising gasoline prices. Gas has increased 36.6% in the New York area compared to last year. And those are the things that are causing consumers some real worry. And they continue to cause consumers worry. And I think we've got a problem now, so we don't have to anticipate that there's going to be a problem in the future.
All right. Walter Field, CEO and publisher of the NorthStarNetwork.com, Julianne Malveaux, and also Michael Myers of the New York Civil Rights Coalition. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.